It's not the definitive last word on God. It's called A Guide for the Perplexed. You're going to accuse me of being frivolous, but towards the end of the book, you raise the question of whether God can ride a bicycle. You say the answer is no, because God doesn't have a bicycle, and indeed he doesn't have legs. There is an alternative explanation, of course, which is that while bicycles exist, God does not.
Yeah, that's another
explanation. You don't seem to countenance that at all.
Oh, I do, yes. I mean, the book is... the book is written from the perspective of somebody who does actually believe in God. But nevertheless, it's meant to be fairly dispassionate, and so I'm open to the suggestion that God might not exist, certainly. And it's not a book which tries to take one line and push it down people's throats. Though, I think, slightly unusually today, it's a book which takes God seriously enough to say this is how it could be believed by somebody.
It's fascinating in how it deals with the way that different cultures, for example, or different epochs in history have attempted to grapple with the idea or visualize a God. There is a contrary view of that too, which is the fact that we, as human beings, choose to either visualize an old man with a white beard, or, as a Muslim, be prevented from any visual description of God. That these are merely indications of the fact that he is a human invention, or it is a human invention.
Yeah. Well, I think God is a human invention in the sense that all concepts are human inventions, and some of them just turn out to be true. I mean, they correspond to what is the case. So I see nothing wrong with God being an invention. It's a question of whether it's a good one or not.
Honora O'Neill.
What I very much like about the book is that you put on one side the thought that the propositions of religion or theology are empirical propositions, knowledge claims, and what we're about is confirming them or refuting them. And you sort of try to liberate what used to be called God talk, I don't much like that phrase, but still, from that constraint. And I understand that, but then I think that each generation faces the problem that if we're going to continue this sort of talk, we have to use concepts whose ordinary use is literal and empirical. We have, in short, to continue to bring up children with accounts of, old men with white beards or whatever else it might be. How do you think that plays? Do you think it's a problem that we have, as it were, always to start out with what, in your account, I think are literal falsehoods in order to step beyond into a more spiritual and resonant conception?
I don't think we have to do that. And I really think it's quite wrong when people look at allegedly primitive myths or stories and say, in those days, of course, people believed them literally. I mean, there's an immense contempt for the common man if you read people like David Hume. They just thought everybody else is a savage but me and my friends. Whereas, in fact, I think those myths, those stories, and religious stories in general, are very profound and deep and are not and never were taken literally by those who really believed them. Perhaps there have always been fundamentalists, by which I mean people who do take them literally. But I don't think religion starts with that. And I think in bringing up children, you shouldn't start with that. I would forbid anybody to...
What would you start with?
I'd start with a sense of poetry, trying to get a sense of poetry, the resonance of presences in the natural world, in human fellowship, the arts, and just to try to get a feeling of the depth of that, and the feeling that here's something objective, as it were, demanding your attention. That's where I'd start, and I'd say, well, the word God ought to come in there somewhere, if it's going to come in at all.
But it's terribly hard, isn't it, to introduce the idea of an unknowable God to adults, let alone to children. And you can see why the idea of a kindly old man with a white beard took root.
I can't, actually. I don't think children are like
that. Well, why did it take root?
I blame Michelangelo, really. And although the Sistine Chapel is very nice, it is religiously horrendous in some ways. And that's where the man with the white beard is. And you say, well, how did this come about? And of course, there is a long story about how it came about. And Christians thought that because God was incarnate in Jesus, therefore you could represent God as a human because he had, in a sense, been one. But it's still, to my mind, immensely misleading to do that. And that's how it actually happened historically, whereas Jews and Muslims were always clear that you couldn't represent God at all. And I don't think Jewish or Muslim children have this hang-up about drawing God. I mean, it wouldn't even be considered as a possibility. I wouldn't want to stop people doing that. I'd just say it's a bad start, and you don't have to do that. You start with children by getting them, not that I'm an expert in education, but to sense what are the important things about human life which makes it fully human. And if the word God doesn't get its purchase there, in the sense of moral obligation, things that demand of you that you act responsibly and attentively, if it doesn't have a purchase there, it would be better for it not to have a purchase.
Can I? I think that makes a great deal of sense to me, but my feeling was, and I found your book absolutely fascinating, my sort of response to that was, you know, you describe how there are sort of three historical, you know, ages or sort of images of God. There's one Platonic one right outside the world, and then a more Hegelian one involved in time and so on, and then a modern one in which I can see, and I took from your book, that you partake, you know, of God as a kind of focus for human ethical commitment to goodness and things of that kind. And what I'm thinking is, why don't we just use Occam's razor here and say, why do we have to invent another, you know, externally this, you know, outside time, etc., a knowable being to as it were, mediate that? Why can't we just commit ourselves to, which takes an equal act of faith, by the way, you know, to the ultimate goodness of humanity in this world without that intermediary.
I think the Primo Levi book makes it very clear why we can't do that, because human beings are not ultimately good and never will be. And if you put your faith there, and this is the trouble about projection theories of religion, if you say religion is a projection of the human, you're going to have a very flawed projection.
Well, not ultimately good, but there's a great deal of, and great huge problem with God being ultimately good too, isn't there, with problem of pain all of that.
Well, again, I think that's the result of, bad drawings as children, because I think saying that God is ultimately good in the classical tradition, which I try to describe in the book, especially Aristotle and Plato, goodness is not primarily concerned with how the world is. In fact, goodness might contradict the way the world is, but to believe in goodness is to believe, well, that's how the world ought to be, and that is demanded of me. It's not just and I think this is, to me, a religious perception. Goodness is not something I choose to live this way. It is something which, as it were, chooses me. And if you begin to speak that language, you're already moving in the direction that people who talk about God are in.
I think that if one applies Occam's razor...
All our audience are highly educated, but just explain Occam's razor.
The idea that entities should not be multiplied beyond necessity is called Occam's razor, and it's just the idea that we shouldn't postulate things we don't need to postulate. But this is, of course, as it were, buying into the empiricist considerations, which I take it you're trying to get away from. So I don't think that's the route by which to move forward. But have I got you right when I think it ultimately comes down to the thought that a rich, deep, resonant way of articulating commitments that go beyond what can be proven or made plausible empirically is something that we can best talk about using traditional, weighted, freighted metaphors, and that includes talking about God?
I strongly believe that ought to be true. The tragedy is it's not always true, and when people go to some churches, of course, they do get very literalized versions that God will find you a parking place on a wet day, and but you won't help other people. And you have to get away from that.
Surely, yeah.
But I think the place to start is where Iris Murdoch, for example, started, to talk about the objective power of goodness and the virtue of attending to goodness. And for that, I feel myself, and many people do feel, you do need to inflate your cosmology a little bit to get value into it. You know? And this is where I so much like what I know about the week lectures coming up about trust, feeling that trust is a fundamental human good, and it's not a matter of proportioning your beliefs to the evidence there. It's a question of staking your life on goodness.
Okay, well, we get to come on to that in just a second, but you're also the Church of England clergyman.
Absolutely.
And I mean, the problem for many of us with metaphysical considerations like this is that the Church gets in the way. I mean, do you believe that this, you're talking, you know, really quite persuasively about the possibility of the existence of some otherness, but do you believe this otherness, this God entity, sits in judgment upon the world? Because that is what your Church tells us.
Well, I think my church is a bit more sophisticated than that, really. And
because you'll come again to judge the quick and the dead.
Yes, but you see, the whole notion of judgment, again, you've got this man sitting on a throne, sheep and goats all going right and left, of course. but that, you say, well, of course, nobody thinks we're either sheep or goats. I mean, and nobody thinks there's an actual throne. The thing about judgment, and Wittgenstein wrote, this was the one religious concept he actually wrote a little about in depth, and the idea of judgment is the idea that the things you do matter ultimately. They are of ultimate significance. And you judge yourself by what you do. And speaking about God is the judgment of goodness upon the things that you are doing. So again, you have to de-literalize this, but you don't...
So when the creed is recited, the actual words are not true. They are somehow...
No, that's where it all goes wrong. They are true, but they're not
literally... I don't understand
it. Well, you
from thence you shall come again in glory to judge both the quick and the dead. What does it mean?
Well, Jesus sits at the right hand of God, but God hasn't got any hands. We just have to get religion into a state where people don't get worried by these questions. I mean, you don't read Wordsworth on daffodils and say, well, how big were they and what was the variety? You know, you get the poetic image he's getting at. And I think religion, while it's not nothing but poetry, it is fundamentally artistic and poetic. And I think that's the heresy of the modern age, to think that religion is science, or quasi, or pseudo, or false science.
Well, it'll be fun to talk about this for ages, but we're going to have to...